today. Somewhere here I have an agenda. We're going to be talking strictly about Department of Administrative Services today. Of course, we have the acronym PIG sitting on the stand over there, so as our guests start using acronyms, we can invite them to drop some dollars in. A couple of things that we want to talk about this morning is we're going to address the Smart Buy program. This is a program that I'll actually have Dugan come up and talk about, but it's designed to try to save the state some money in terms of and being able to use our buying power. And then we want to go into, we did a survey. I think I gave you all the results of the survey. I hope I did. And if I didn't, I apologize, and we'll make sure that you all get that. Anyway, we did a survey of customers of the Department of Administrative Services, and we're going to, there's a couple of areas that according to the survey, have brought up some issues that I would like for us to address as we're looking at the department and see how they might be able to improve themselves and figuring out where some of the dollars that we, that Ways and Means provides for them goes. But with so to start things off, I'd like to ask Dugan to go ahead and come up. And this is kind of an overall, generalized kind of presentation to give us about the Smart Buy program. And Dugan, let me turn it over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Dugan Petty. I'm the Deputy Administrator with the State Services Division of the Department of Administrative Services. You should have in front of you a presentation, Mark Dorgan, Smart Buy Project Update, and I'll be using that to go through with today's presentation. This presentation will cover a number of topics. I would like to give you a Smart Buy overview, give you some background on the contractor selection process and the contract. Background on the contractor that was selected to assist us in the Oregon Smart Buy Initiative. Talk about the opportunity assessment process and a little bit about sourcing. That's actually how this thing works. I would like to give you an update of the project status to date, how we've met goals, where we're at in the process of meeting goals. Talk to you about strategy to achieve savings, how we achieve savings, how we measure that, how that's captured, examples of how agencies benefit from the Smart Buy program. Talk a little bit about the hard dollar savings methodology, agency participation, and then close with some success stories in addition to the savings that we've achieved, but some of the other things that we've been able to accomplish. On page two, just briefly, high-level goals or overview of the Smart Buy program. Smart Buy project was identified to create and sustain cost savings for the state of Oregon while maintaining high-quality government services to the citizens of the state. So at the very beginning, we knew we wanted to achieve savings to the extent we could. We wanted to drive down the cost of operation related to what agencies spend on goods and services, but we didn't want to compromise the quality of the products that they were getting unless the quality of the products were needed to be compromised. In other words, we wanted agencies to be able to get what they needed to get their job, but at the best price possible. Wanted them to get what they needed to get their job done, but at the best price possible. So three basic objectives. We wanted to achieve during the 2003-05 biennium somewhere between $10 and $18 million of savings, which we believe to be possible. So that was really our bar. That was our goal. We wanted to foster statewide buying cooperation to get alignment on buying things in a different way and buying things that were adequate to meet the state's needs. We knew that would involve agency participation. And we wanted to improve our buying processes, and very important, we also wanted to do knowledge transfer to the state purchasing office, because we knew that we didn't want to be in a position where to achieve this way of doing business, we would always be reliant on consultants to help us get there. We wanted to be able to learn these techniques and begin to employ them in our day-to-day operation in the state procurement office.
Dugan, let me just ask you a question about the objectives. Because one of your second bullet here is foster statewide buying cooperation. Now, for years, the state has run a cooperative buying sort of program.
Yes.
Cities and counties have participated in that. I think special districts have probably participated in that, utilizing the buying power of the state to then reduce their own costs. So how was this going to be different than what was already being done?
I think they complement one another, Chair Crummell. This in no way lost ground on the Oregon Cooperative Purchasing Program, and I think, as you'll see in later slides, it actually really improved outcomes for political subdivisions, school districts, local governments that participate in buy-off of state contracts because they simply got much better pricing than they were before. But when we talk about statewide buying cooperation, it was really using a broader match of user groups and engaging like the chief information officers to set configuration standards around personal computers. It was bringing in a broad group of users to be part of the sourcing teams and part of the user groups that advise those sourcing teams on what the essential products would be for office supplies, for example. So it was really trying to, within the state, bring people together to reach consensus on what was adequate to do the job, as opposed to state procurement office figuring that out to the best of their abilities with maybe a little less input from those groups.
So, in other words, with the cooperative that we've had going, we haven't really been able to completely maximize our buying power then. And the idea behind this program is to increase that buying power so that we can get further price reduction.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's correct. We think there's room for improvement, continues to be room for improvement. We have rough numbers, about 1,500 political subdivision organizations that could be part of the Oregon Cooperative Purchasing Program. We have about 300 that are our members. Now, that's a significant number. It's a major group of people, but there's greater opportunity here, and we think this offers them some opportunity. We also talked to Oregon University System about being a part of this to see if that would be something that we could even get greater leverage on. When we put the RFP together, made it possible for the Oregon University System to buy off of our contract for the consulting services. So we put that in as well to see if they wanted the opportunity to do it. As well, we were working with the state of Washington, who we've had a long-standing relationship with around cooperative purchasing, and we included them as a potential purchaser of services from the consultant. And actually, we brought them into the steering committee by giving them a seat on the steering committee. They're chief procurement officer in Washington State, so they get monthly updates in the steering committee and handouts, and have, in fact, used the contract to engage in a contract with our consultant to do a strategic sourcing effort in Washington.
Oh, so, really? Because Washington has had quite a program going for some time as well, particularly over the last 3.5 years that I'm particularly familiar with.
That's exactly right. But it's not a replacement. It's really complementary to it, because what it does is at the central state procurement office level, I think it delivers better contract outcomes than what we had before. And so to the extent that with any of these structured cooperative purchases, these contracts offer better pricing opportunities, that's just a win-win for everybody that buys off of those contracts.
Now, is Oregon also a part of the Western States buying cooperative that's sort of headed up, I believe, by New Mexico? I think New Mexico was sort of the driver behind that.
Oregon has been one of the founding members of the Western States Contracting Alliance. It began in, I believe, 1991. Its goals are to establish where it's beneficial to the states a kind of a forum for doing cooperative purchases at an interstate level. And so Oregon has participated. One of the early contracts that came out of WSCA was for laser paper, computer paper, that Oregon led. And it has participated in a number of those contracts, including cell phone contracts. In the past, it was involved with the personal computer contracts that was led by New Mexico. That's since gone, I think, to Minnesota as the state that is now leading the cooperative.
Right.
We buy drugs and pharmaceuticals through the Minnesota Multi-State Cooperative. So Oregon continues to participate in the Western States Contracting Alliance, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Page 3 it really has a lot of information on it, but it attempts to quantify the steps we went through from the time in which we sort of began talking about strategic sourcing and our decision-making process about whether we thought it made sense for us to do. It moves on to from information gathering to scoping the project, then conducting the RFP and selecting the contractor. The idea of cooperative or strategic sourcing really came to us probably in March, and the director's office asked us if we were familiar with strategic sourcing and if we thought it was something that made sense. And we said, well, we knew a little bit about it, but we needed to gather more information, which we did. And after a fair amount of information gathering, then the question was, do we have the capability of doing something like this ourselves, or would we need help from a consultant? And we looked at it. We understood that cooperative purchasing was going in and looking at your data from your financial management system, your contracting outcomes, and figuring out how your pricing on your contracts compared to what you should expect to be getting in these markets for a comparable organization of your size with your spending power. So it's benchmarking that. And then the other part of it is going out and actually establishing contracts to get better pricing and measuring how you've done. And we looked at it. We said, you know, this is exactly what we should be about. It's the strategic contribution that purchasing should be making to the organization. It's about getting the right thing at the best price possible, and that's exactly what we ought to be doing. But do we have the capability to do this on our own without a consultant? No, we didn't think so. So the next step was, well, if we need a consultant, how do we go about getting a consultant and what makes sense to Oregon? So we spent probably the month of May and most of June going through a scoping process. We contacted three states that we were aware of that had actually done a strategic sourcing initiative. That was Delaware, Virginia, and Florida. And we talked in detail about what their experience was, how they went about doing it, how they funded it, what the outcomes were, what the lessons learned, if they had to do it again, if would they do it different, how would they change. And then we also went out and asked any and everybody that provided strategic sourcing services to come in and have an informational interview with us so we could learn more about how they conducted their business, how it worked, and to figure out how we could make that work within the state of Oregon. At the time, John Latimer was working on this as a special project, which was helpful to us, and he spent a fair amount of time on the internet finding any and everybody who's out there. We scheduled interviews, and we learned quite a bit about how this had been done in the private sector. We learned that there were a number of ways to do it, and one of the popular ways to do it was through a gain-sharing or contingent fee basis, which was we have a contract with a consultant, and they'll go in and save a certain amount of money, and they'll document that money, and then they get paid on a percentage of whatever the savings are. And we looked at that, and we looked at other methods of doing this, and we tried to devise a solution that we thought made the most sense for the state of Oregon. And what we came up with was really a two-tiered process. We moved away from the idea of a gain sharing because we felt that, number one, we wouldn't know for sure what we were getting into, and number two, it would put us in a position that we didn't want to be in because we would be driven by a contract who was driven by a contingent fee basis. So we came up with an approach where we thought was a good one, and it's proven to be a very good approach, where it was a two-tiered process. You could call it a look-before-you-leap process. But what we wanted from the consultant was for them to come in and do an opportunity assessment and to look at our savings, our spending across the enterprise, go in and get into great detail in our financial management systems, pull up our spending, look at our contract pricing, look at benchmarks and come back with us, to us, with a projection of how much they believe that we could save in these categories if we went forward. We wanted a high comfort level projection of what the savings would be. And we wanted to understand that in the context of the categories that we thought we could reasonably do over the course of the biennium. So we wanted to understand savings, and then we wanted to, rather than say, okay, we're going to do this and we're going to pay you so much of a percentage of fee on that, we chose to go a different way. We chose to get a firm fixed fee on what the price would be to get those savings so we could, in effect, do a cost-benefit analysis against it. Because we didn't want to get into it. What we'd learned is that the contingent fee approach will get you in a situation where, yeah, you may have documentation about saving a lot of money. You put the consultant in the driver's seat. You basically lose control because they have full rein on where they're going. And those percentage savings at some point can be very, very high. And there can be a serious question about whether or not you paid the contractor a reasonable amount of money based on what those percentages were. So we chose the method where we understood what the savings were, what the possibilities were, or the savings were up front, and then we negotiated a fixed fee for the contractor to go out and do those savings.
So Dugan, what was the fixed fee that we negotiated?
There were two fees. The way the RFP was structured, the fixed fee, which was based on what they proposed in the RFP, was $250,000 for phase one, which is to do the opportunity assessment. And then the cost for the second phase of the project, the wave one, if you will, where the categories were then sourced and completed and savings tracked, was just under $3.5 million.
So based on this document that we have in front of us from Marina and Company. And by the way, where is Marina and Company located?
Their offices are in West Lynn.
They're in West Lynn. And were they selected by you, or were they selected by the contractor?
They were selected by us. We wanted part of what we came to as we scoped the project is we learned from Florida that the other two states didn't have any kind of an independent audit review. And Florida, when they were bringing up this approach, used an independent auditor, and we thought that made good sense. So from the very beginning, we had this strategy that we would go out and contract for the sourcing consultant, but we would also establish an independent third-party contract with an independent third-party reviewer to validate the savings methodology and to review the savings reports to make sure that they made sense and were reasonable representation of savings.
Okay, and so let me get sidetracked here. So to date then, because what they're saying here is the cumulative from April 5, 2004 through November 30, 2004, cumulative reported savings and total dollar impact are $5,028,072, or 34% savings was realized. And so at this particular point, at $3.5 million plus $250,000, so it's $3.75 million, you know, give or take a couple thousand, we have paid the contractor about 75% of what our savings are. Is that correct?
Well, that was as of November. There's a lag in the reporting because the reporting mechanism is based upon the vendor-prepared reports, not the strategic sourcing, but when we have the supplier who has a contract, they're required to report on spending to us, and that spending report that they give us is the basis upon which we build the savings reports. And then Marina reviewed those savings reports. So there's a lag there. So that we've got additional information that updates this in the report. But they are due to give us another report. They should be due to give us another review, I believe, in May. We'll take what our savings reports are in May and have them review those.
So is this kind of like me going to Albertsons and using the little card that I got in my wallet, and then they tell me how much they saved me on that particular trip? I mean, it's a vendor generated report. So
no,
the vendor's saying Dugan, you know, you guys could have spent $4 million with us, but you only spent $3.5 million, so see, we saved you $500,000. Is that kind of how that works?
That's where my wife shops.
Mr. Chairman, that's not exactly how it works. We can get into more detail with these slides, but in a nutshell, we make projections on what we save based on what the cost we paid before we do the new contract, and then the cost that we get after the contract.
Okay.
And so we know what the differential is in pricing. What we don't know is the volume that we spend, and we get that through the supplier report.
Gotcha.
So then we know what we're spending with the suppliers. We calculate the savings. That's not calculated by suppliers, but it's based on what the suppliers must give us. And then we calculate that savings. We're doing that. The strategic sourcing consultants did that while they were under contract. They've set up the reporting mechanisms and the spreadsheets, and now we do that with staff in-house. And then that report is reviewed by the third-party auditor that goes in and makes sure that it all hangs together, makes sense, and is a reasonable representation of savings.
Representative Butler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dugan, as I read the report, two things jump out at me. One is the fact that they had to change their expectations, that because the over at the top of page 2 on 2A, item number 3, contributions recognize a variety of considerations and assumptions such as, and 3 is recognition of an incremental vendor collected administrative fee of VCAF as revenue. It was treated as a savings. That's probably one of the more unusual approaches I've seen to a saving, is describing how much money we collect as a savings from a third party. And then I noticed over on in the middle of page 3, they discuss that reevaluation of the formula based upon the adjustment for the inclusion of the VCAF and the results. We objected to referring to the additional VCAF in the context of savings when it is, in fact, an administrative charge. This resulted in employing the term hard dollar impact as opposed to dollar savings. Because if I can go out and charge somebody else an additional dollar amount, I'm assuming that here they're configuring that as a hard dollar impact as opposed to dollar savings. So when I go back to number one, the conclusions under number one, the cumulative reported savings and total, I assume that's hard dollar impact reported for this approximately 6 month period, was $5 million. Now, without skipping ahead in your presentation, your overhead presentation, Dugan, do we break out the VCAF? And that's demonstrated. And then flipping back over to Marina's report, at the bottom of page 2, it talks about work performed. Have you got that in front of you?
I do.
Could you just open it, please? Okay. So at the bottom of page 2, it talks about the analysis work they did on Silver Oaks computations. That's item number 1. Then I flip over and I've got A and B on number 1. I don't have a number 2, but then I go to 5 and then 3 and 4. Do you know what number 2, the work that they did as to number 2 might have been?
I believe that their 5 is actually their 2.
Oh, okay.
I think it's just a mistake.
Okay. All right. I beg your pardon. Okay.
They didn't let Word number it for them.
Sometimes it will, with odd consequences.
All right.
But Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, that's right. And when we went to the e-board and requested funding of $4.1 million to do the project, and the idea was to pay for that $4.1 million out of the proceeds for the project. When we worked with the steering committee on how we should fund this project, and maybe one of the most difficult parts of pulling this kind of initiative together is how you pay the cost of the project. The steering committee came to, after looking at a bunch of different things that different states had done, the steering committee came to a recommendation that I think was pretty solid, and that was to fund it through vendor-collected administrative fees to the extent that those incremental vendor-collected administrative fees could make sense for these various categories, and then what couldn't be recovered from vendor-collected administrative fees during the biennium to be covered from a one-time assessment. And so those were the funding mechanisms that caused us to pay for, that covered the $4.1 million to pay for the project. So then the question was, this vendor-collected administrative fee, how do you account for that? And so we saw that as no net cost to the state, because it's really built into the pricing structure. So initially we put it into one big bucket, which was hard dollar savings, which were the actual savings plus the fee that was collected by the supplier from the agencies built into their pricing as they paid for the product, and then rebated back to the state to pay for the cost of the project. So those were the two mechanisms that steering committee came to. Those are the two ways that we recovered the cost of the project for the biennium. So when Marina looked at it, they said, this is really revenue, not savings, and they asked us to break that out, which we did, and as we get further into the presentation, you'll see how that breaks out. Because we have hard dollar impacts, it includes vendor-collected administrative fee, and then we have the spend reduction, which is the difference between what we would have paid and what we are now paying. And those two make up hard dollar impact, and you can see how their relative relationship to one another further on. So what we decided to do, after talking to all the suppliers that we could find, after talking to the states that had done this, was to do a phased development contract, which would allow the state of Oregon to look at an opportunity assessment, figure out what the potential for savings was, and then also then negotiate a fee with the consultant to figure out what the hard dollar cost is to do the project. We then put together a request for proposal, and we issued it on June 30th, and we sent it out to everybody that we could find. Page 4 outlines the evaluation criteria that we use to evaluate the proposal. We use a best value method, which is really a combination of overall quantity, price, and various elements to give the state the best opportunity. So we looked at proposals, qualification experience, their key personnel, their specific plans and methodologies about how they would do this in Oregon. We wanted to look closely at how they documented hard dollar savings. We wanted to look at their pricing methodology for phase two, which would be now the how are you going to do the sourcing and what kind of price would you charge us. That allowed us to take into consideration the gain sharing approach versus a fixed fee negotiated price approach, and then we also looked at the overall pricing. Let's take the how much you're going to give us for fixed fee and add it to what we think the outcome would be for your phase two charge, and let's factor in points for that. And then we had points associated with references, which were very important to go back and check. So we had 9 respondents in total, and the awardee with the high scoring proposal was Silver Oak Solution.
You got some pretty big names there.
Yeah.
I mean, Accenture, Deloitte, Denali. Is it Denali out of San Jose?
I think they're out of California. Yeah. They're not probably as large as Accenture or McKinsey or AT Kearney. Their primary focus is on sourcing and sourcing solutions. When you look at Deloitte, Accenture, yeah, McKinsey, they cover a broad range of different kinds of consulting services. Denali, strategic sourcing solutions, and Silver Oaks were more specific to doing strategic sourcing. They don't have a range of management consulting services as some of the others did.
Yeah, Deloitte is an accounting firm. It's one of the biggest ones, and their range of services that they provide is everything from accounting to auditing to and then they've of course gotten into the IT world.
That's correct. Yeah. Now, Mr. Chair, I think we saw in the proposals one of these kind of the classic difference between a large accounting firm that has a bunch of different things that they do and then smaller focused firms that are very specialized in what they do. And I think that it was interesting because the two proposals that came forward is the closest were Silver Oaks, and then the next one down would have been Accenture. But I think the relative value came through in terms of how specialized and focused they were. And the other thing that I think that told us was both of those firms had contracts with other states, had had some experience in states doing strategic sourcing. One of the criteria we had was we wanted to know about experience they had in other states and similar sized organizations doing sourcing. It didn't necessarily have to be in a state, but we wanted to look at organizations that had the kind of organizational complexity that probably a state does, because a large part of how you can be successful is how you work with the infrastructure in the state, and that's proven to be an important evaluation criteria, I believe.
So, with regards to Silver Oak, did you look at, for example, I mean, I know they've done work for Virginia, and you mentioned Virginia. Did you also look at the work that they did for example, New Mexico?
We looked
at what some of the results out of New Mexico have been.
Mr. Chairman, we looked at what Silver Oaks had done at the time in Delaware. We spoke extensively to their counterpart to the Director of Administrative Services, Gloria Homer, who had nothing but high praise for the sourcing approach and their work. And then we talked to Ron Bell, who was the Chief Procurement Officer in the state of Virginia. At the time that we had our RFP on the street, those were the only two states that Silver Oaks had a contract with. And then we talked as well to Florida, who had a contract with Accenture to do strategic sourcing. If you turn to page four.
Did you look at West Virginia by any chance?
No.
Okay. Because a couple of reports that I got, it appears as though both New Mexico and West Virginia have been less than complimentary, and I was just curious as to whether that was anything that had come into play.
Well, at the time we put our RFP out and made the award decision, New Mexico wasn't doing sourcing. They very quickly asked us, as did a number of other states after we made an award, what we were doing, how we were doing it. We shared our RFP with them, and I know that New Mexico used our RFP model, and other states have as well. I think because it's really a makes sense approach. You don't have to jump into the pond. You can sample the water to decide if there's a cost benefit to going forward. So that two-step approach has found some popularity with other states who have followed us. I have got a further slide that goes into some detail about the contracts that Silver Oaks has with other states, and then the other states that are doing sourcing.
Okay, I'm just curious about that because the report that I've got out of New Mexico, in particular, shows that they were, I believe it was New Mexico, and it might have been West Virginia. I think it was New Mexico. Anyway, that they were supposed to have generated somewhere in the that it was on the contingency basis. That they were going to pay, and I might have the state wrong, but they were supposed to pay 50% of the savings up to a maximum of $8 million to Silver Oaks, and somehow what's happened is that they've been paying 100%, and they're supposed to pay up to the $8 million 100%. So, quite frankly, there is no savings to the state at this particular point. And then, for no pay then beyond that $8 million, the contractor is supposed to stay on board until there's been at least $16 million in savings shown. And I was just curious about that. So, but it's interesting that what you negotiated with them was the flat fee basis, and so and obviously you're looking for greater savings, but it was based on a flat fee as opposed to doing it on the contingency.
And Mr. Chairman, what I have heard about New Mexico has not been that. It's that it has been successful. If they followed our model closely, they would have gone with a flat fee basis.
Right.
I know that others use contingency fee contracting or gain-sharing contracting. I think those are I think under the right set of circumstances where you have a good deal of knowledge about what you're getting into and you've got a real good sense of what the outcomes are likely to be, those could be appropriate tools. They need to be evaluated very carefully. I would not support that kind of effort for doing strategic sourcing because I think there were just too many unknowns. Maybe in the future I might reconsider that, but everything I know about it right now would suggest that that's not a good way to do it. And it actually builds a potential conflict of interest, which scares me, because then the consultant's reinforcement around this is really to drive this in ways that get the most savings for themselves. And I think you need to have better deliverables and better controls on it than that, because that will take a state organization in directions it may not be able to go in. We set up a mechanism as we did sourcing to allow for certain decision points. One of them was to require the sourcing teams to develop a sourcing strategy and recommendation about pros and cons of how to move forward with it. And we always wanted to be in control about whether we did an incumbent negotiation or whether we went out to bid or whether we even choose to deal with a particular product or service. I mean, we realized that we had some value propositions that we talked about. One of them was doing business with minority and small business contractors. One of them was doing business locally. One of them was not losing ground on the ground we've taken on sustainability and environmentally preferred purchasing. So those were things that we did not want to lose ground on, and we wanted to help move forward in those as we did strategic sourcing. And the fear around the gain sharing is that you wind up with absolutely the least cost possible, and you trample all over some of those value propositions, and so we wanted some control points on that, because we didn't want to get into a situation where we disadvantaged a local supplier yet we saved a bunch of money. So we wanted to keep some controls on that, and I just would be very nervous about that and that gain sharing proposition. And so we've not used that method. I think that our RFP, I mean, could allow for that. I'm not sure. I don't think that that's the methodology that New Mexico used, but there are other states. There are as many as 15 states that are now doing strategic sourcing, and probably another half a dozen that have had some experience or are thinking about it. Mm-hmm. And I know that Illinois uses a different methodology. Florida has used a different methodology. Pennsylvania has used a different methodology. And you know what? Those may be perfect in those states. I think part of what you have to do when you do something like this is take the time that we did in the front end to figure out how you can design this to work that's compatible with the culture you're working in and the state environment you're working in. And they're different from state to state. So, frankly, I think we've done an outstanding job of implementing something that makes sense in the way we've done it in the state of Oregon. I don't know that it works in other states, but I think it's worked pretty darn well here. So,
I appreciate that, and I think probably the key thing that you said there, you know, talking about Illinois and Pennsylvania and so, and the different methodologies that they've all used, and Florida and so on, is that they've used what they think is going to work for them, and you use what you think is going to work for Oregon, and I appreciate that it wasn't just sort of they did it this way, so we're going to do the same thing, but yet at the same time it's relying on a particular model so that you're not sort of reinventing the wheel.
Yes.
As well, so I appreciate that. That's,
there are some key constants in it. One of the keys to this is doing a thorough evaluation of your spending across the enterprise to figure out where you're spending your money, and then another constant is figuring out where your prices are. So what are you getting for your money right now? Measuring that, putting those up against fact-based benchmarks in a given market. What should we be paying for a certain item? And those are key constants. You got to know, you got to understand that. You got to have good measures to set targets to know where you want to go. So that transcends systems. But how you get it and how you implement it is different. And then how you decide to source them. When we talked to Gloria Homer in Delaware, very successful project, saved money, high accolades for strategic sourcing and for Silver Oaks. One of the things that they said that they would do differently if they did it again was they drove it from kind of a top-down approach. They alienated their procurement office. They had a lot of pushback. They lost a lot of employees. And to us, that didn't seem like a very good way to do it. So we structured in a way that we engaged our procurement office. We had a focus on training. We wanted to learn because we wanted this to last. We think it makes sense to do. So we used our procurement office rather than having the consultant go out and be the lead. We shared our procurement analyst with the consultant's analyst and co-chaired what we did in these sourcing teams. So we learned as we went, and we were in control, and we made decisions, and it was a part of the state procurement office. So when talking with Gloria, she said, you know, if we had to do it again, that makes good sense. That was a good way to implement it. So that's one of the ways that we did it differently here, but we thought it made sense for the state of Oregon.
Yeah, that's interesting. Did you have a question,
yeah,
Mr. Rosenbaum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Dugan.
Good morning.
I guess my question is sort of a fundamental one, which is, what is it that these consultants know that we don't know as the procurement function of state government? It would seem like whatever it is they're doing, going around the country making all this money, is something we should be able to import and just make that a function that we do automatically.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rosenbaum, that's a great question, and that's kind of the thing that we struggled with early on. And that was kind of there was a threshold question the director's office asked us early on, is that this thing seems to make sense. Can we do it ourselves? And we looked at it, and we decided what it is that we didn't have the capability of going to four different data systems, pulling out that data, going through that data, massaging it, cleaning it, and putting it in the categories in a way that you could actually make some sense of it. So they were able to come in and do that in a pretty short period of time. And I hate to tell you this, but if we were trying to do that ourselves, we don't have the skill sets, we would still be here trying to figure that information out. So that's something we have to figure out how to get to. But we didn't have that. Well, the other thing we didn't have was the benchmarks that they could tell us for a given product what we were paying and what we ought to be getting. And part of what these consultants bring kind of in their toolkit is knowledge of what they've done, and particularly those consultants who are in the sourcing business, because they've got these benchmarks from their other sourcing engagements. They know what somebody like us ought to be paying, so they can tell us that we're paying 25% more than we should be in office supplies, for example. Our method of awarding on office supplies in the past was, we did a bid, we got competition, we got the first price, and we awarded to the low bidder. That's as good as we could get, but do we have a way of knowing that award to the low bidder got us the best pricing possible for office supplies? And that was the missing thing. So they were able to give us that. The other thing that they were able to give us is consulting expertise in the various markets that we just don't possess. We have good people working hard to do a big job in state procurement. We've got a small staff who's asked to buy any and everything that the state of Oregon buys, and we buy a lot of different things. It's not possible for any of those folks to become experts in these categories to the depth necessary to be completely effective in that market. So we take general strategies and we put them out there, and we do the best we can with those general strategies. But the way you buy automobiles is not the way you buy copiers. And the way you buy computers is not the way you buy computer information systems. And so when it comes to things like telecommunication data and any number of things, what the consultant gives us is the ability to bring somebody who has knowledge and expertise in sourcing these kinds of things in the marketplace to give us the idea of the best way to go about it, what works currently in the market, and give us a better approach in terms of best practices, which, teamed with our folks, gives us a better opportunity to get better outcomes. And so we get the ability to get data. We get structured reporting mechanisms, which they gave us, so we can report on how we're doing. How much do we save? But not only how much do we save, but how much we actually realize downstream. They gave us those things. So they have a tried and true methodology that's worked very successfully in Fortune 500 companies in the private sectors for a decade. And what's happened in the last 5 years, partly because I think of the downturn in the economy and partly because states have all been under the gun financially in the last 5 years, is many of these sourcing consultants who have taken these private sector techniques that have worked well in private sector companies, and they're now bringing them to the public sector. And the public sector, for the first time, is saying, yeah, that's something we ought to be looking at and we ought to be doing it. And the trick is, how do you integrate that in an effective way into your given state? We formed a sourcing committee, and this is a little broader part of your question, but I think it goes to it. We formed a steering committee of agency, 18 to 20 different agency people to help us make decisions around strategic sourcing. We also put on that steering committee, thanks to Intel, they offered their supply manager to give us any kind of advice and kind of an advisory role. And Don Moore is with Intel here in Oregon, has responsibilities for Intel across the country and in Asia. A purchasing professional, she will lecture at Oregon State University, has a degree in supply management, lives it, breathes it, thinks it, understands it. She's done great training. We invited her into our steering committee to advise us and make recommendations, and they have done this in Intel. They did it a couple of years ago, a little different approach. Different. They used IBM as a consultant, but the same basic steps. So what we're doing here works, and it's the kind of thing that even large corporations, Fortune 500 corporations, will go out and buy that knowledge to come in and help them do that, but they don't necessarily need to own it and pay for that on an ongoing basis. So the trick for us in Oregon is how we understood that. We actually had a component of training in here, or knowledge transfer, as we call it, because we want our analysts to understand how to use this tool, and we're working now on how we integrate this into our daily process. And other states have kind of done it as a project. Illinois is probably a leader in trying to initiate it into their daily process. So I'm sorry for the long-winded answer, but I hope that gets at your question.
Now, follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up, Representative Rosenbaum.
See for a state as small as Oregon that it would be hard to have the expertise to do this in-house, but it seems like if you look at the size of a state like California, they've got to be as large as most Fortune 500 corporations. So has anybody looked at a nonprofit method of doing this function, either through, you know, a professional association like the governor's, Council of Governors Association, or doing something that would sort of pool this expertise?
State governments or MCSO?
Yeah, or the Governors Association. Yeah. I mean, has anybody looked at pooling this expertise among the states and just doing it in a nonprofit way?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rosenbaum, I think it's early. California has their own initiative now. They're one of the states. They began this in the last 6 months. They had substantial conversations with us before they did it. So they're doing this as well. The Western States Contracting Alliance, as Representative Crummell has, Chair Crummell has mentioned, is actually right now in the process of trying to establish a contract for the 14 Western states that would have a menu of strategic sourcing consultants on it. So that's as close as anybody's come to that at this point. But I still think that from what they've done, the real work is figuring out how you craft the integration strategy into your state. And so even though the Western states may come up with a number of contractors that they've awarded contracts to, I think for anyone to figure out how to make that work within their state, you still need to go through a process very similar to the RFP, where you figure out how you want it, who's going to give you the best approach to doing it in your state. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
We pick up on page 5, talk a little bit about the contract backgrounds. We used a phase development contract, which gave us the ability, as I've said before, to look at the opportunity assessment, pay for that, and to decide if we wanted to do more work. And when you look at the doing more work, generally that's done in strategic sourcing as waves. And we did one wave during the during the current biennium, and we'll talk about the categories that were in that wave. So it allows us to complete that and then would allow us to do a second wave if we chose to do that.
Okay.
Or further waves. Now, most of the states have done multiple waves, but at some point, I'll tell you, I think there's sort of a law of diminishing returns here, because this is, to some degree, you use the picking the low-hanging fruit method to do the waves, and at some point, the cost versus the cost-benefit, the return on the investment is down. So at some point, you say, it doesn't pay to do this with a consultant. We'll continue to use these techniques that we build within the organization, but probably doesn't pay to do it with a consultant. I'm told from talking with consultants and people that we've worked with to understand this is that they tend to cycle back in. Maybe after 5 or 6 years, and the consultant would come back in and resource a category because things will have changed enough. But right now, we use this phase development approach to do it by waves. The fees we've talked about, the fee for wave one was $250,000, which was, or the, not wave one, but the opportunity assessment. And then the wave one, which is sourcing, knowledge transfer, monitoring and tracking, monitoring compliance and tracking of savings for this first wave, which was completed in February, was $3,466,000. The contract has a 2-to-1 warranty, which means that for every $2 or for every $1 of contract cost, the consultant will guarantee that they will give us $2 of hard dollar impacts. Now, we've got a fixed fee, so if it turns out that they don't, for the categories we don't source, if we don't achieve the 2-to-1, they'll come back in at no cost and stay here as long as it takes to get those savings at no cost to us. So that's not a bad guarantee. Duration of the contract, the initial term was through June 30th of 2005, or approximately 20 months, and that the phase two category waves could be added by amendments. Phase one was completed ahead of schedule, and then phase two, which was the first wave, that the categories that we sourced, was completed in February of 2005. So the tracking, the monitoring, the follow-up is what's left after we've done that. The term of the contract may not exceed 5 years.
Okay. Rick, any better?
Thank you. We've been on the overall objectives, the measurable hard dollar impact was to be a savings of 10 to 18 million. That's a pretty broad spread, 10 to 18
right.
million. But it also indicates that the letter from the accountants indicate that through the 6 months we get 5 million in savings. So I'm assuming that you're estimating that you will have the 10 to 18 million dollars.
That's correct.
During the current biennium. The second issue that I wanted to ask about was that improving the processes and transferring knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
In this process, are our staff at the Department of Administrative Services and procurement staff, is this knowledge being transferred in so that they can compare this series of options and see that wherever they're at in the state, that it's better to buy gasoline on this contract, though it's 0.2 cents more expensive right now, it'll give us more security during this period of time.
Mr. Chairman, you're correct about your first assumption. The knowledge transfer has involved really kind of two approaches to knowledge transfer. Very structured, formalized training where we took the entire state procurement office staff and we went through step by steps the 5 methods in strategic sourcing. Broke them down, went through kind of textbooks examples, case studies. We did that concurrent with actually working on the strategic sourcing waves. As I said earlier, we asked the state procurement analyst, the analyst, for example, who was responsible for office supplies. When we did office supplies, which was one of the categories, they were co-chairs. They went through all the steps and were really coached and taught along the way and worked through it. So at the end, we've got expertise at some level now that we've picked up. Now, could we take our group of of analysts and go into the strategic sourcing business? No, we're not at that point. But do we have some understanding of what's involved, and have we walked through the techniques, and can we do some of the techniques on our own? Yes, we can. There are some gaps that we are working on, and the gaps have to do with the strategic data capture, and part of that is taking... we have four different financial management systems that we tap for this information. And how you pull that together, put that in categories, and come out with meaningful data is still one of the issues we're wrestling with. But once you've got that, then I think you're in pretty good shape. And then the benchmarking piece is another one. And we're working on benchmarking. In the last Ways and Means, we rolled out, Representative Butler, a performance measure that had a market basket of common items that the State Procurement Office buys. And we were comparing that performance measures against other prices that we got, that other neighboring states, Washington General Services Administration got. So we're beginning to have some experience with that and beginning to work with that. But there's more to be done.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Due to my recollection that we have a procurement degree that is offered through Chemeketa in conjunction with our work for DAS procurement, and that we had folks that were trained in this. Is any of this knowledge being transferred back to our community college system so that it can be used and shared throughout industry in Oregon?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, we have a class that we conduct in conjunction with Chemeketa Community College. It's called Business Administration 161, and it's a class on sourcing or public procurement. And we use that as part of the training curriculum in which the procurement office issues Oregon's State Procurement Officer certification. And we will be taking, as that class is retooled again, I'm sure some of the strategic sourcing techniques and tools will go into it. And I can tell you why I'm sure of that, and it's because, as you're aware, we rewrote the procurement law substantially last year, and in the last 18, 24 months, we have been revising the rules that we use for state procurement to coincide with the procurement law revision. We also had this strategic sourcing taking place simultaneously. So some of these techniques that we thought made sense to use, we put into the rules, and we'll be training on those rules.
So is one, if I can follow up. BA 161, is it enhanced as a result of what we're learning then? So this knowledge, this communication and sharing of knowledge, and the transferring thereof can be enjoyed by other businesses as well as future beneficiaries that are sent over by the department to that course.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, yes. BA 161 is being enhanced, but BA 161 and any enhancements we make to it will not suffice for a complete regime on doing strategic sourcing. We're in the novice stage. I think we've had good success here, but we had an excellent consultant working with us to help us get there. We're crawling on this, and so I don't think we're in a position where we want to pull out of it. We've had special concentration on the knowledge transfer piece, because had we not contemplated that, it wouldn't have happened, and it would have just gone on. So we'll have some success of pulling some of this out and learning from it, but it doesn't make us the definitive experts in strategic sourcing.
And Mr. Chair, I think my issue was that certainly wasn't that we were creating 100 new employees for Silver Oaks. It was that we were creating within our own cadre of employees the transferred knowledge base as to how to be able to do this within the state better for ourselves in the future, recognizing the change of paradigm that's going to be necessary and what things to look for, but then also out of that, the BA 161 or other expanded courses offered in that administration would be able to provide students additional opportunities to grow in our own community, so that when I go take 161, 162, and 163 down at Chemeketa, I'll come away with many of the tools that will be necessary so that I can go to work for HP or Tektronix or Nike or someone else and assist them in their supply chain management.
we're contributing to that.
Thank you. Okay. Well, I'll go ahead and let you get back to your slides here since we keep...
Let's go to slide six, the contractor background. I'll just cover this briefly. This gives you some background information on Silver Oaks. They are focused on strategic sourcing and sourcing solutions. They're a relatively young company. They have a great deal of expertise and experience. They have offices in Boston, New York, Philadelphia, San Francisco. They've completed over 535 sourcing projects across 150 categories, and they have worked with 10 states at this point. You go to the next slide, slide 7, I think you can see this demonstrates where we were at the time we made the contract award. There were really two leaders that had experience with states at the time of the award. Silver Oaks was one, and Accenture, who had contracts in Florida and was, I think, just awarded a contract in Pennsylvania at the time. So Silver Oaks at the time had Delaware and Virginia. Since then, they've added the states on the left, on the right, as well as political subdivisions. Also, it's worth saying that Pennsylvania, Illinois, California, Iowa, and Texas are also engaged in some form of strategic sourcing with consultants other than Silver Oak Solution. So you can see that that's 15 of the 50 states, 33% of it, of the states are beginning to think that this makes sense. And I think you can be proud of the fact that actually Oregon is not the early adopter, but is really, I think, respected as a leader in how we've implemented this. Doing this, as we've come to learn over the last 18 months, there are many, many ways you can go along with this. And we've been, I think, successful in not having to step into too many of those. So let's go on to page 8. Page 8 gives you kind of an overview of what the opportunity assessment consisted of. Silver Oaks looked at $1.62 billion of spending, and they looked at it across the statewide financial management system, ODOT's financial system, lottery corrections, and our purchasing cards. So they went in and pulled data up in 2003 from all of those systems. $270 million of it they took out as something that's just not subject to sourceable because they're payments to other states or bond payments. That left us with $1.35 billion of potential sourcing. They looked at about $300 million of that in a what they called a deep dive or in-depth review to figure out whether there were opportunities. Let's go to page 9, slide 9. This gives you really a breakout of the categories that they thought offered the greatest opportunity, and they recommended going forward with these. This is the highest opportunity for savings and the relative ease of capture for us to go after them. And so that's in the top right-hand quadrant, and these were the categories that ultimately became the categories that were sourced in wave one. And this is based on the data review, again, financial systems, state contracts, and also supplier reports. So they went back and got more detail from suppliers, and then they compared those prices to benchmarks that they had. On December 18th of 2003, we recommended this to the steering committee. The steering committee looked at it and made the decision to move forward and recommended it to the director of DAS. And in January, then we submitted the project to the emergency board, what we believed were savings opportunities and what the cost of the project was. And the emergency board approved that, and then we moved forward.
And that was January of 04, correct?
January of 04, yes.
Yes, thank you. Dugan, before you go on, what is ITPS and what is TCPERS?
TCP, I hope this isn't for the printout.
I was going to say.
But it was a trick question. But no, I would have to be paying for it. So no, I really am curious as to what those stand
telephone
for.
Telephone Customer Premises Equipment is what the acronym TCPERS stands for. And this is the phone system, the handsets, the phone systems, and the services that are included in that. Yeah. And then the ITPS is Information Technology Professional Services.
Okay. Thank you. And that's okay. Even if it was a trick question, Lori will cover it for you. She's in the audience.
Mr. Chairman, I tried to be on my best behavior so far.
Mr. Chair.
Reverend Butler.
I've got two questions relative to that matrix. I know that the state of Oregon spends a rather significant amount on fuel, and maybe that was one of the items that was screened out here on page 8. I don't see that anywhere, and the second question I've got is down under janitorial supplies. We know that we've run into some issues relative to folks buying custodial supplies in at least one department. I'm wondering if this matrix also may have given us any kind of an evaluation of our internal control in this process, or that's probably outside the scope, but I see that as in one of the low probabilities of savings opportunity, but under the higher end of the ability to capture the savings. That issue that came back with the kickbacks at ODOT, I'd like you to address that relative to custodial supplies, and then where am I missing the purchase of fuels?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, we received from Silver Oaks a stack of reports, probably about 6 to 8 inches thick, that broke down our spending by categories and with suppliers and dollar amounts and by agencies. And in that, I'm sure that fuel purchases were looked at. I don't recall that there was ever a lot of discussion around fuel. I think that it was clearly seen. I suspect what happened was they didn't believe that there was a way to bring better pricing, because there may not have been a whole lot of competition on that. I'll go back and ask staff if there had been much discussion on fuel. I don't think there was a lot that I recall. If it had been one that had risen to the top as a category that made sense, I recalled that. So for whatever reason, it didn't come out high in this $300 million, but it probably was in there. With respect to the janitorial supplies, when the issue arose with the Department of Transportation, I actually went back and looked at that stack of reports to see if I could get a view of that. And to some degree, I didn't see any because of the reporting. What we get in the data that we look at is only as good as the data that's reported into the financial systems. So on the PRISM reports that we got, I couldn't find any reports of expenditures against that particular product. So I don't have an explanation of why. I can tell you, though, that is exactly the thing that they look for in the data to see if there's fragmentation of the purchasing. Because if there's fragmentation of the purchasing, then that tells us we're not getting the most purchasing leverage that we could get when we're out there buying. So that's one thing that they look for. And then after we put these contracts in place, we get a compliance report that the consultant gives us that tells us how much we're spending on the contract and how much we're spending outside the contract. And that's important, because if we're spending outside the contract, we're losing the savings, number one. And number two, we're also not delivering the kind of leverage that we want to have when we're buying. So I think part of the issue related to the Department of Transportation, regardless of whether we had done strategic sourcing or not, is that we had a contract in place, and that contract should have been used. And there is an obligation when we put a mandatory contract in place that we expect agencies to buy off of that contract. And that didn't happen in that case.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Butler.
One follow-up, and I'm leaving you here with kind of a raw nerve with regard to the potential concern for not having the competition on the fuel bids. I just invite you, and as much as you have Director Warner here too, I just invite you to go back and take a look at the procedures that small users might have to go through. I think what you've got is the state is a fairly captive audience because of the rigors mm-hmm. that you go through. And as you do that, I don't know how many times I considered public contracts as my brother and I ran some fuel operations that we since leased out to other folks. But But I know this, that every time we looked at a state bid, that it was so restrictive, and incidentally, we knew what the other folks were getting into it for, and we knew that there was a, it was a very, for lack of a better term, I'm just going to tell you, it was a very greasy project. There was a lot of money being made on the state of Oregon on those projects, on those contracts. And all I would say is this, maybe what you ought to do is just come back in and say, how can we make that a little more small business friendly, so that we can get, rather than the folks that are selling 90% already to the other agencies and have their foot in the door, that you might be able to allow those other folks an opportunity to bid on that. And you might find that the big bidders, once they realize they got all the competition, you might save 20 or 30 million bucks statewide, because 2 or 3 cents a gallon is going to make a lot of difference in the state of Oregon. And because it is such a closed shop right now, you've got a lot of people who have been just backed away and just sitting out. We're not willing to bid. We're just not willing to go through those kinds of hoops. And I appreciate the fact that you have, particularly with regard to the ODOT's bridge money, now an outreach to try and bring minority and women-owned businesses and those kinds of things online. But maybe that same kind of outreach needs to be done by DAS as well, to just say, let's review what we're presently doing. And again, if you just brought in one new bidder in that process, in every new location where you're presently bidding for fuels, you just brought in one new bidder, that just the introduction of that competition into the market, and I'm not saying this based upon just guessing. I know that it's the case, because we sat and watched it and said, hey, the kind of volume that you're doing there, we could underbid this 2 or 3 cents. But to go to dance through the hoops, and 2 or 3 cents on 100,000, 200,000, 300,000 gallons, that starts to be pretty good money, and that's for Ontario, your shops in Ontario. So I'm just asking you to maybe take a look at that.
Right.
But again, I don't see fuels as an item here that's in the high end of the savings or in the high end of the capturing. So the folks probably looked at it, and I don't know that was in the scope of where Silver Oaks was going to go. They probably weren't looking at your contracting methods as much as they were just your supply contracts themselves, and saying, on this bid, we think that you could have gotten, you know, this for this much less, or if you would have put this out to bid, you could have got it for this much less. So I guess I'm anxious about another step of examination behind the scene, and that would be our overall contracting process.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, thank you for the consultation and advice.
You have to pay for it.
Yes, very good recommendation. We'll look at that. Those are exactly the kinds of things that we need to be looking at as we do sourcing, because it is about competition. It is about getting the best price. So that's very helpful. And I will follow up to find out how it is that how fuel came out of that first opportunity assessment. Thank you.
Thanks. Dugan, what you could do is kind of start hitting the high points here. I know we're about to get into the hard dollar impact and that sort of thing, but, we're okay, though, because whatever we don't do today, we're carrying over to Thursday, correct? Okay, I just wanted to make sure I got those. Yes, that's what we're doing. So anyway, go ahead. And I do have some questions in particular as we start getting into the particularly the PC peripherals and servers and kind of that kind of stuff. So go ahead,
Mr. Chairman. Let's then the page 10 simply talks about the categories that we have sourced, and the one category that we're still completing, we've are negotiating terms and conditions on the information technology professional services contract. We're going to use a managed service provider. We've got a steering committee set up to help guide us with that process. So that one, our staff is finishing up on. The measurement mechanisms are in place. The contract has the initial notice of intent to have been awarded. And if we could, we'll move on to page 11. Okay. This really begins to get to where we're at to date. This is report is based on supplier reports that were given to us on January 31st, that were due on January 31st. We then calculate the savings based on these reports. We go in and apply the savings methodology to the actual amount that was purchased and come up with the amount of hard dollar savings or hard dollar impacts. So you can see the categories, and I'll take you through this spreadsheet so you can get a feeling for what we've got here. So the categories we on the left are the categories that were involved in Wave 1. They're office supplies, telecommunications, cellular, cell phones, express mail, long distance, telecommunications long distance, this is our AT&T contract, software, tires, and tires is what was left of what was at one time a vehicle category, and vehicle parts and tires, and we decided not to source vehicles because at the same time the consultant was making recommendations, we were also looking at moving to alternative fuel vehicles, which didn't have as much competition for the alternative fuel vehicles. PC peripherals, copiers, and copiers is kind of an interesting one because they looked at copiers and they found that the pricing that we got on our copiers in the most recent bid was pretty darn good, and they didn't think they could do anything to better that. But they were able to help on the demand management side, that is, making sure that we weren't buying too much of a copier, that we were buying the right size copier. And we've had savings about getting the copier that we really need tailored to our use. PC hardware, which involved hardware, laptops, desktops, and some low-end servers. Telecommunications, the CPE and related services. This is what we talked about, the telephone customer premises equipment, and then the information technology professional services we talked about. So the first category, the first column on your left is the pre-smart biannual spending. Based on the 2003 baseline, this is looking at all the financial management systems, this is what they found to be the annual spending for these categories. Okay. The next column is the hard dollar impact start date, and what that means is when these contracts became effective. And so the earliest ones were the middle of June of 2004, which were office supplies, and then you can see that at the time we did this report, the IT professional services wasn't effective yet, and then the telephone customer premises equipment had just been awarded in December of 2004. So what you got here is a ramping up of these contracts as they come into place. And then we have the next column is the date of the most recent supplier report. So the supplier reports that we got that our savings reports are based on, you can see what the date is of that. So there's still, for all of these, we still have about 6 months until the end of the biennium that none of this captures. The next column shows the range of the estimates of what we believe to be the opportunity for our hard dollar impacts, and the ROB is rest of biennium. So it's what we believe to be the potential hard dollar impacts for the rest of the biennium or the 2003-2005 biennium. And so for office supplies, for example, we thought that was a reduction of 3 to 5.4 million. The next column, and that gives us the range, incidentally, and this sets the goal of 10 to 18 million, as you see down below.
Right.
Yeah. So that was our target, to fall somewhere in that range. The identified hard dollar impact in the next column for the rest of the biennium, identified means now we've sourced it and we've made an award, and it's the difference between what we were paying pre-smart buy and what we're now paying. And so that's what we think is the hard dollar impact times the amount of savings that we think we'll have from the time the contract is put into place to the end of the biennium. So what we believed at the time of the award was we had $10.4 million of identified hard dollar impacts. Then the next column, which is grade in here is the reported hard dollar impacts based on the supplier reports that were received so far. So this is how we're doing year to date, if you will. And that is that we've
got... Year to date or biennium to date?
Biennium to date.
Okay.
Yes, you're right, Mr. Chair. Biennium to date, 4.9. And then the estimated average for future months, this is what, based upon the identified savings, is what we believe to be what we think is we're going to get in savings for future months. And then if you add all the future remaining months, that's the next column for the rest of the biennium, that's 6.2. So that's our best guess at what we're going to have for the balance of the biennium. And if you add that column, the 6.2 to the 4.9, that's then projecting right now the next column, which is the best estimate of hard dollar impacts based on what we've measured so far, what's actually been reported so far, and what we project to be reported for the rest of the biennium, which would give us 11.5 or 11.1. So at this point, it looks like in hard dollar impacts, we're going to bring in about $11.1 million as a result of the project. Over the life of these contracts, that'll exceed $50 million hard dollar impact.
So then, are you to figure our real savings? Then, if the best guess comes true, then you would back out the 3.75 that's been paid to the contractor, and that
right.
gives us what our actual
net, yes.
real savings are, correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct, except it's more than the 3.5. It's the 4.1, which is includes not only the consultant for the strategic sourcing consultant, also includes the cost of the third-party auditor, and also includes the four staff positions that the E-Board approved for the biennium to do the project in debt. So if you netted those out, that's what this would do.
Mr. Chair.
Reverend Butler.
So a total of $4.1 million of estimated cost with a total savings of $11.2 million in savings. And these are actual hard dollars captured, hard dollars
the hard dollar
impact. So truly we will have expended by the time this is done, about $6 million less than we had previously expected. These are savings captured in various departments.
Sure.
And then the last question I have is relative to the audit note from the Mariner accountant. Wanting to know what the hard dollar impact is versus the VCAF in the context of the savings. And again, I'm assuming that's going to be shown as. And Mr. Chair, I just have to tell you straight out, it's hard for me as an accountant to say that it's a savings because we went out and charged somebody some money to gin up our revenue. So, but I can appreciate where you're coming from. VCAF is a strange animal that government uses to send out some bills to people to make sure that the costs are evenly borne by the folks for each of the department functions of gas. So, and where are they here, the VCAFs?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, if you turn to the next page, this is a breakdown of a savings report, and I'm going to skip. I'd like to skip over 12 and come back to that, but if you go to page 13 or slide 13, this breaks down the hard dollar impact, and we've actually shown here in this report. These two slides, slide 12 and slide 13, are part of the monthly reports that we get from the consultant, and now we're generating ourselves where we track the savings, and. They not only show, in this case, savings for state agencies, but they also show the savings that are resulting from the Oregon Cooperative Purchasing Program members. So those political subdivisions that buy off our contracts, they show savings here. I have to tell you that those savings weren't shown on that previous spreadsheet that we're looking at. We were just looking at state agency savings. This breaks down hard dollar impact. So the spend reduction as of January 31st, for agencies, if you take that first column to the left, what was reported, reporting period identified, so the identified savings for that would have been, for just that 1 month period, would have been $698,000, and the cumulative identified, and this again is what was done at the time the contract awarded, was $3.8 million. So now let's move over to spending reductions. What was actually reported, what's actually been saved here, was during the period $1 million, and then cumulatively from the beginning of our smart buy contracts to the time this report was prepared, which is based on data that was current as of January 31st, the total savings, and this is savings, is $4 million. $62,951. Now, if you, this will not coincide with Marina's report because Marina's report was done based on November completion information. So, they'll come back and quarterly do another report. But we're using the same tracking methodologies that they've validated and approved. So we're at $4 million as of January 31. And if you move across, we have rebates. Those are what the contractor is willing to give us back on these contracts, and there's a total of $500,000, and it's Boise Cascade and office supply. And then the incremental VCAF, and that's what was put on these to pay for the cost of the project by the steering committee, and that is $372,000 cumulatively to date. So you can see that it's a small part of the total figure. And you're right to be keeping your eye on, as I am, the cumulative reported spend reduction, because that's the savings. Now, at some point, when we've recovered the cost of the project, we need to convert the vendor-collected administrative fee to, we need to discontinue that and pick that up in price reduction. Shouldn't be a problem, because it's already built into pricing. So what we do is we should convert that to price reduction, which would then move that over into savings. Instead of the supplier rebating back to us this fee, they should simply take that percentage amount and reduce their price by that amount. So that's additional savings that would then be passed on to the agency. And then it does move over into the savings column.
So at that point, Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that the state would not be sending bills out to contractors, third-party contractors that are providing services to the state, because they would already have identified the best place to shop without having to say, well, Jimmy, that's the best price that we can get. Now, why don't you jack up the price by 10% so that we can cover our costs for having figured out that this is the best price? And you're looking to say, well, Jimmy, if we'd have just bought on the lowest price contract, we'd have got it for less than that. So I appreciate what you're saying in that regard, Stephen. But the question I've got then is the agencies. I should be able to look at page 11 and come up with some of the same numbers, and because these are both through January 31st. There's a spending reduction plus the rebate plus the VCAF. There isn't a total on that page, is there, of those three?
Page 11.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, if you look on page 12, we couldn't get this spreadsheet onto letter size. And as this report actually is presented to us, page 13 would be in the middle of the two elements of page 12.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so if you look at the far right column, the total hard dollar impacts, now that we've broken that down, they roll up to the total hard dollar impact.
From 13, if I look at the agency cumulative reported, they're $4.062 million plus the $500,000 Boise Cascade rebate plus the VCAF of $373,000. That should total them the $4.935 million under the cumulative hard dollar.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, that's correct.
And excuse me for asking this question again, Mr. Chair, but the agencies versus the ORCAPs, ORCPPS, what are ORCPPS? I've forgotten. I don't do well with these acronyms.
Mr. Chairman, that is the Oregon Cooperative Purchasing Program, and what this represents are counties, cities, special districts, and school districts spending off of the Smart Buy contract. What this shows you is that cumulatively, they've spent $12 million, where state agencies have spent $19 million. And then in terms of cumulatively reported savings for them, or hard dollar impacts for school districts, political subdivisions, at the time this was reported was $3.9 million. So the savings that those Oregon Cooperative Purchasing Program members have enjoyed is just under $4 million. It is also worth saying here, when we talk about vendor-collected administrative fee, that one of the reasons that the steering committee thought that that made sense to put into this to cover the cost of the program was because it gave the political subdivisions an opportunity to contribute to the cost of the project when they made a purchase off of a Smart Buy contract. So had it not been for that, and had it been done just through agency assessment, then the cost of the Smart Buy project would have been 100% on the backs of state agencies. So this is a little more equitable way of distributing that.
Dugan, you brought up a couple of points as you were coming through, going through these last couple of slides that I just want to clarify. So, is buying on the contract required of agencies? Is that in DAS rule now, or?
Mr. Chairman, it is in DAS rule, and it requires agencies to get dispensation from DAS if there's some special reason that they can't buy off the contract. It is important for agencies to purchase off of this contract for a couple of reasons. One of them is that we've made our best effort to get the best pricing possible from suppliers with pledges of giving them our business. And so to the extent that suppliers see agencies buying not on the contract, then they're not going to trust that that's going to happen in the future, and it's going to erode our ability to get better pricing. We do understand that there can be certain circumstances where it's just not practical, and we allow agencies to have dispensation to go off of the contract. At the time we were implementing the PC contracts, there were projects that were in place, in progress, where changing suppliers for these projects in midstream would have been problematic, and so we granted some approvals to some agencies to continue on with the brands that they were buying, even though those prices weren't as good as what we were getting on the Smart Buy contract.
Okay.
So I missed the mechanics of how the Oregon public purchasing can be spread to the cooperative other that's of the $4.1 million, and I missed the mechanics of how that works. I need to have a little bit of a better feel for that, doesn't it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, the vendor collected administrative fee is collected from purchasing agencies, authorized purchasing agencies on the Smart Buy contract. So if it's a state agency or if it's a county or a school district, built into their pricing is an administrative fee that is then rebated back to the state that helps us recover the cost of doing the project.
Okay, so the $373,000 that we've collected on VCAPs is intended to cover the $4.1 million or some fraction of the $4.1 million based upon other local governments and participants, cooperative participants, so as to share that cost. Okay, and it doesn't look like we're going to recover it at $373,000 for the thus far. I mean, fortunately, if they're doing $19 million, or we're doing $19 million worth of volume, they're doing $12 million worth of volume, it looks like it ought to be shared roughly on a base of 40-60.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, the 4.1 cost recovery is assumed to be covered in three ways. We first figured out what we thought was the maximum amount we could get through the vendor-collected administrative fee without completely overpricing contracts. and what we're likely to get around rebates. And between the two of them, we figured that was about $1.1 million. The balance of the cost of the project is picked up through a one-time agency assessment, and that's right at $3 million. So that's how we recover the cost of the project. And the agency assessment, they get savings in this budget cycle, and then they pay with the assessment.
And Mr. Chair, clarification is that DAS charges that you've got various branches of government in the way the constitutional setup is. How do you charge that against the Treasurer's office, against the Secretary of State's office, against judiciary? Are there, and then within all of the agencies that DAS administers directly, there's a couple of different kinds of fees that are charged there.
Right. Now, Mr. Chairman, the assessment model breaks down to the agencies that are currently subject to a DAS assessment. And that was based upon what the 2003 pro rata spending was by those agencies in these very categories. And so we calculated their share based on what their spending pattern was in these categories in 2003. And so we took the 3,000 and we allocated it out based on that 2003 spending in those categories. But some of these agencies that could buy off of this contract, like for example, Oregon University System, we don't have an assessment for them. They're not part of the assessment model. So when they buy off of these contracts, they do pay a vendor collected administrative fee, and a portion, and then that rolls in to cover a portion of the contract cost. But you couldn't pick up $4.1 million in any kind of a reasonable vendor-collected administrative fee. You have to come at it in a variety of ways.
Mr. Chair, I guess in that regard, I appreciate that the vendor-collected administrative fee is one that's not going to be able to be used. My anxiety would be that DAS would have some kind of a, as opposed to the general government fee and other service charges, maybe there ought to be a direct service charge related and actually administered as a direct service charge. I realize this is right now a one session kind of a thing, but there ought to be a smart buy service charge out to the various agencies and included within that probably it ought to have been a bill to the Oregon University System for their share, so that everybody picks up their share of the $4.1 million, and it be administered back to the government. And then that one-time service fee goes away at that point, and then everybody gets an opportunity to share it and pay it, and enjoy the benefits. Because if they come back and say, "Well, Jiminy, I'm going to object to my paying $372,888 of VCAF because that runs up the fee over here," but then if they look at it and say my share of the savings is X amount and my share of the actual bill, here's the bill of what what DAS is actually service charging out for Smart Buy Oregon, it looks like to me that would be a more equitable way to do this and actually place in as a one-time fee for the $4.1 million that we've got that's having been paid and authorized through the e-board, and actually charging it and letting them pay it, and then recognize that they each have some savings, significantly more savings than what the actual one-time service charge for Oregon Smart Buy would be.
Mr. Chairman, I think you hit on one of the difficulties around doing an initiative like this, and it's how you recover the funds. One of the beauties of this is that you're able to really amortize your cost of the project in the course of a single biennium. When we talked to other states, they were kind of amazed at that. But one of the benefits we had was an early start on this, and a two-year budget cycle. If you were in a single budget cycle, it would be very hard to make this work.
So, kind of following up on that, so you had the assessment to the agencies. Now, is that assessment going to continue to be charged to them?
Mr. Chairman, it's a one-time agency assessment.
Okay.
So it went with this wave one of this sourcing.
So they got a notification. So they're, I'm in the agency head of, I don't care, XYZ agency.
Way to capture them.
And I now have gotten this notice of assessment from Department of Administrative Services for the Smart Buy program, and I don't really have a choice. So now it's being pulled out of my budget, whether I want it to be or not. Correct,
Mr. Chairman. That's correct. That's the way assessments.
And so now all of a sudden, my budget already maybe being tight, and so I'm going to get hit for another 50 grand, 100 grand, whatever the amount is. But there it is. I mean, it's just so now I'm short $50,000 or $100,000 or however much I've been assessed.
You're short that, but you also, based on your spending behaviors, should save that amount of money if you spend it at the rate that you spent in the last biennium. And beyond that, the next biennium and the year after that and the year after that, there are savings that come from this project.
So then if I say, well, you know, okay, I don't want to buy on the contract, then I'm just going to be short the money. If I buy on the contract, then what's in it for me is that I get my 50 or 100 grand back based on my spending habits, and it should be at least a break even.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Now, there could be a fly in the ointment, and that is that if you've spent for some reason $50,000 on something the year that we baselined it, your assessment's going to be based on that. If it turns out that you only spend $10,000 this year, then we're going to be off. But we had to make an assumption that spending behavior would be about the same.
Relatively the same. Okay, so that brings up another issue, and I'm going to go ahead and go because we're going to run out of time here. And Lori, I apologize to you for not getting you up here today. I kind of wanted to, since we started with the Smart Buy, see if we can conclude this. But on Thursday, we will talk about the survey and some other gas issues, and so we'd like to have you up first on Thursday. Is that okay? Thank you. So it kind of brings up some issues, though. One of the things that I was looking through is the information relative to the personal computing stuff and going to different vendors. And I know that this was a hotly contested sort of a deal from a standpoint that you had several folks bid, particularly on the personal computer side of it. And the decision was to go with, I believe, Hewlett-Packard, and which can claim local company status, by the way, and then CTL, which is a company based out of Beaverton. But one of the things that I'm curious about, and I know that Dell was real kind of ticked off that they didn't get selected and didn't win an award and everything, or win a contract award and everything too. But one of the things that I am curious about is that, so I'm an agency, I've got all this Dell equipment sitting there, and I know that I'm going to have that now as I buy new computers. If I'm going to buy on the contract, I have to switch over to HP or CTL. Which does carry an additional charge for me because of the imaging transfers and software transfers and all of that kind of stuff. So my question is, in some respects, as an agency, I might sort of really be hard pressed here to. Am I going to be able to see the amount of savings on the contract, for example, in that kind of a situation? So let's say, okay, I'm going to go with CTO. So now we're going to start buying, and we're going to be transferring those over. Am I going to see enough savings on the contract buy to cover the assessment that I've just been charged? That I had, there was a committee over here that made a decision about my future, only I wasn't invited, kind of a deal. So I'm going to get charged this assessment on one side, and I've got to pay for, because if I'm going to buy on the contract to save my money there, I now have image transfers and those kinds of costs. Am I going to save enough on this contract to cover all of that and at least break even, or am I going to take a bath on one end or the other?
Mr. Chairman, my expectation is you'll save that much, but there, how much you save depends upon the individual situation. With respect to personal computers, and maybe other things that fall into that category. Our buying approach in the past was we had a variety of different contracts. In fact, we had every major manufacturer contracts with them, and we got as good a price as we could negotiate with every major manufacturer. That resulted in a variety of different shops, and it didn't, on an enterprise level, drive us to the best pricing possible. We were trying to figure out how we can reduce our cost of operation and yet still get agencies what they need to get their job done. So this provided this really provided a different way of doing that. If we take the idea of having brand-specific agencies across the enterprise to its logical conclusion, we don't have any competition in the future. We have Agency X who has Brand X, and they're never going to want to change. The fact of the matter is that when they change, even within a brand, there are certain costs associated with that that they have to take into consideration. Sure. We attempted to look at that as we put the bids together, the RFPs together. We required pricing on the asset tagging, the image management. We also included pricing on product take back because we wanted to deal with the end of life issues around PCs. So we put all of those into consideration so that agencies would be looking at this from a total cost of ownership standpoint. The other thing we did was we engaged the chief information officers in determining what the configuration standards would be. So you talk about an agency that says, well, I wasn't on this committee or I wasn't on that committee. We built the steering committee to be very large so that we got alignment around this and that we understood what we were doing and we got valuable agency input. We had communications working both ways. And I think we couldn't take 105 agencies and put in that, but it was pretty large, and so we had most of the major agencies involved. We worked with the Chief Information Officers Council to set up the configurations, and at that early meeting, there was a discussion about being able to do something that's plug and play. I think if you talk to the CIOs, we've come a ways in the area of personal computers, at least to recognize that they are pretty much plug and play anymore.
Right.
And so there was an understanding that that's what we were going to do, and maybe some expectations that the pricing might have come out differently by different suppliers. But I tell you that HP got very aggressive in their pricing, CTL got very aggressive in their pricing, and the other suppliers didn't get as aggressive in their pricing. And so if we reserved the right to award to multiple suppliers or a single supplier, and we believed under that award scenario that was going to give us sufficient suppliers to cover our needs and drive the best pricing possible. If we had gone back to an award scenario where we had awarded a contract to everybody, we wouldn't save the kind of money we've saved because people would have continued to buy at the older pricing or pricing that wasn't as aggressive as what we've awarded on.
Okay.
And the fact that we took into consideration the asset tagging and the image maintenance, we got pricing on that. We looked at that, and even figuring that into the calculation for some of these shops to move from Brand X to Brand Y, yeah, it still looked to us to be a significant savings.
Just so you can represent, brother, one of the things that I found interesting is from a letter that you had, I believe you had sent to Senator Farioli, talking about, you know, and I think part of it was kind of a justification about CTL, and I don't have any dog in this fight, so it doesn't really matter to me one way or the other. But one of the things that I found interesting was that in the appendix that you had attached, the CIO responses to an email survey in which you were asking, you know, given the choice, would you buy HP or CTL? There wasn't any of the ones that responded to you that said they'd buy CTL, and I found that rather interesting. And a couple of them even made the comment, you know, that, well, they've already got two deals going, and they don't want to get a third one going, so they're going to just, you know, they would not be purchasing. I just found that rather interesting that because there is, to a certain degree, as you well know, in the IT world, there is a certain amount of product
brand
branding. There's a certain amount of brand loyalty that occurs. You know, some people say, well, I've had a Dell and I've always had a Dell. By God, I'll always have a Dell, period. You know? And then there's others or Gateway. I mean, you know, put your brand here kind of scenario. And so I just found that interesting.
You had a question?
I did, Mr. Chair, and that is just one item with regard to the rebate itself. And the rebate, the Boise Gas Gate rebate could be deceptive in some respects. Truly, that is a modified VCAF in many respects, because it is not a direct it's not a direct cost savings. It's an indirect cost saving spread across, and that can bastardize your results in the following fashion. We know that we're getting the best price from them, and then they've rebated in order to make sure that we've got the best price. They rebate $300,000 or $500,000 under the current example. The difficulty with that is that if I've got somebody in a state office that needs a ream of paper in Burns, Oregon, and they open up their Boise Cascade catalog, it says $3.49 for that ream of paper. And they check with the local store downtown, and they say, we'll sell it to you for $3.12. They don't understand that there's a $500,000 rebate for buying Boise Cascade paper in that process. So it does bastardize the results slightly, but I don't know to what extent.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to get back to, I'd like to answer both of these questions. First off, the $500,000 rebate in the case of the Boise contract, one of the decisions we had to make with each of the sourcing categories when we had a current contract in place was, do we cancel the contract and go out and rebid it? Or do we do incumbent negotiations? We know our prices are high, but do we attempt to negotiate better pricing? In most cases, the consultant told us that we would be better off to cancel the contract and go out and do competition. In some cases, we said we've got a long-standing relationship with a supplier who's got a substantial investment in Oregon, and one of the tenets that we have is we're going to conduct ethical business and how we do our business, and so we want to give them an opportunity before we go out, and we want to give them an opportunity to get their prices down. That's what we did with Boise. The rebate was not part of the evaluation criteria. It was, can you get to the kind of pricing we need to not go out to bid, and that's what we got. So it didn't factor into that decision. Had we gone out to bid, that could have been something we could have considered into an evaluation factor, but we hadn't done it in that case.
But if I may, Dugan, how would you respond to my constituent in Burns, Oregon, that worked for the ODOT, that said, I needed to go out and get some cardboard to say, $3.95 is closed from this point forward. An emergency situation. Check with my suppliers. They said, you gotta buy it here. You can't put out a cardboard sign unless it's one that's approved through our cardboard supplier. And so she went down with her own money and bought it at the local store because she said, number one, it was available to me instantly and I had to stick it up. And number two, it was cheaper than what my catalog supply price would have been had I waited the 3 days.
Yeah.
And taking that to Bruce Warner and or former Director Krennican, the comment was, that's no longer the policy. You, first of all, it's a safety issue. Take care of it. And second of all, you buy at the cheapest price wherever it's at. And if it's at your local hardware store, you buy the poster paper or cardboard signs there. So.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think if there's an emergency circumstance, that's one thing. But what we've tried to do is get the best overall pricing for the enterprise based on a broad variety of items that we're buying. There will be, in any set, any line item, in any given time, there's a chance that somebody's going to get a better price. But that doesn't mean that we're not saving big dollars across the enterprise. And that's, I think we have to accept that there's going to be some of that. I'll let you know that because over the years, this question has been so tough, particularly around Costco, that when we awarded the office supply contract and when we got our pricing, I sent staff into Costco to compare our prices because I didn't want to get beat up with it, well, we can get it at Costco cheaper. We did find that for paper, it was cheaper, but the reason it was cheaper in Costco is that they bought that paper by truckloads. Earlier, the price was already set, and that's going to happen occasionally. but by and large across the enterprise, these are substantial savings.
Mr. Chair, the pre-smart buy authorized annual spending for office supplies is $11.1 million. A $500,000 rebate is no small item. That mm-hmm. represents over 4%, something less than 5% of the total of that. So when you're comparing, and something is a nickel higher on a dollar, then what happens is they say, well, it's less expensive by buying it over here. Again, they don't see the fact that if it's a $3 item and they're saving 5 cents on it, that there is a $500,000 rebate from that one office supply right. contract. And I guess that's what I'm concerned about, is that it's hidden in that overall equation on that.
And that's one of the reasons why it becomes, I think, one of the things Dugan pointed out, so important that the buyers be educated on how this program really works and that sort of thing. So I appreciate it,
Mr. Chairman.
Dugan, I'm sorry.
If I might get to your point about CTL and the CIOs for a minute, I think that's an outstanding example of why something like this is important to do and why coming to these configuration standards makes sense. If you look at page 22 of the presentation, it talks about some of the success stories. Well, it talks about the award to CTL. At the time, we asked the CIOs. Very few of them said that they would do anything other than maybe give the CTL the courtesy of sending in something to evaluate.
Sure.
And so left to their own decision-making, I think that suggests that there probably wouldn't be a lot of movement. Now that they've had some opportunity, we've got some success stories around this. DAS, DHS, Judicial Department, Public Utilities Commission, Forestry, and Justice are buying from CTL. Now, at the time we did this information, it was February 28th, but they received 4.6 million in orders. The Department of Human Services is delighted with the support and service they're getting from CTL. Because they're a local company, they're nimble, they come in, we visited with them, they put, instead of shipping their packages, individual computers, they bulk package them, they'll bring them in, so they're put their mice all together, they go in and set them up, they take the boxes away, they'll take the computers away, the old computers as part of the product take-back program. DHS is delighted, and they're saving dollars against them. So I think that just goes to show that if you've got to sometimes take the tough stand and take the enterprise-wide approach. Nobody other than DAS really was in a position to bring this about, but it does drive savings. But if you allow agencies to make decisions around this based on their own interest, it's hard to get them to that position. So there's really been a change of behavior happening around CTL, and I think this demonstrates that.
Okay, and that's, you know, and like I said, I don't have a dog in the fight. It doesn't really make any difference to me one way or the other. And I am familiar with CTL from my nearest past life of being a technically ignorant person selling technology, but I am familiar with CTL and some of the things that they've done, and I know that they, for example, the D-Link product is one of their products that you can walk into Fry's and buy, and Fry's carries it system-wide,
right.
and they do offer very good price. Well, Fry's does. I do have one other question relative to the PC stuff, Dugan, and that is one of the, because in this memo that you sent back to Senator Winters last October, and I recognize that it was sort of, you know, some of what precipitated that is, you know, Dell and some of the challenges that they had and everything. But one of the things that I noticed in there was that for laptops, for example, you are actually going through CDWG, which is a company out of Chicago, and actually is a channel provider as opposed to a particular company. So they, you know, they might provide you with CTL, or they might provide you with IBM or HP or any number of products that are out there. And they only want, but they want a contract for notebooks. At the time that you specified that, because I noticed in the stats, it doesn't say what brand it is. But I did notice when I went on CDWG's website that the brand that our contract calls for is actually IBM.
That's right.
And it's the IBM ThinkPad T42, which is comes in a variety of different configurations and that sort of thing. And I was just curious as to how that worked going with a channel provider as opposed to a particular company.
Mr. Chairman, there are a couple of interesting aspects about that. One of them is that I think this is an example of how we have worked with the Chief Information Officers Council. The user group that developed specifications for this developed a laptop specification that required that little device in the middle of the keyboard that looks like the end of a
joystick.
The joystick.
But that's just me.
I have never been able to make one of those work, but that was important, and that was one of the configuration standards. So consequently, the awards to be compliant with the spec had to have that. And unfortunately, we found ourselves rejecting some pretty aggressive pricing because of that specification, but that's what the group required. The proposal from CTL was joint CTL-IBM, and it was, they had always proposed that this joint CTL-IBM, so the award was always, we always knew that it was an IBM ThinkPad that would be provided by that channel partner. I think HP got the other award on laptop.
Right.
It's interesting that the distribution network, particularly in this industry, continues to evolve. I mean, when we started buying computers a few years ago, at least within my career, we were buying them from local computer stores down the street from resellers. And sometimes we were buying brands that we'd never heard of before, and then there were also the brands that we were familiar with. And then there came this evolution led by, I think, Compaq, Dell, and maybe Apple had something to do with that, of the manufacturer's direct approach. And then we've seen Dell be tremendously successful with that, and Gateway being very successful, where they haven't had those retail stores that you were getting the order into the manufacturer in Round Rock, Texas, and they made it as you ordered it and sent it out to you. And then we're seeing a little bit of movement now back to having some of those franchise retail stores. And so we've seen, you know, at least Dell now has kiosks and malls, and Gateway has tried to have some local stores. We're also seeing some channel partners becoming kind of the emphasis, and I think that the model for HP, for example, has been maybe working through channel partners as opposed to the manufacturer direct. And we're seeing, in fact, we're allowing a channel partner to come in to provide service around HP on PCs, because it allows that channel partner in some cases to have an inventory to act as sort of a shock absorber where the manufacturer wants just in time. I mean, they want their supplies coming in the door, and they want them out that afternoon in the form of a product, and they don't want to have any inventory in stock because that's a cost. So those then go out to some of the channel partners. And we're seeing, I think, an evolution kind of away from maybe that manufacturing direct model to one where channel partners are being used more and more for some of these items. So I think that industry continues to evolve.
I think you're right. Thank you. Dugan, we're out of time. And thank you very. You're out of time, and I'm out of people. So thank you very much. On Thursday, we will continue this, and we'll actually have Ms. Warner up to talk about some of the other aspects of DAS. Appreciate your briefing on the Smart Buy program. With that, I'm going to close the information hearing. We will stand adjourned, especially since I'm back.